This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. As a law student at the peak of the Vietnam War, Flint Taylor wanted to make a difference in the fight for civil and human rights. He and other lawyers teamed up to form the People's Law Office. Together, they took on clients and cases that were steeped in the fight for civil rights. He worked on the case of slain Black Panther Party Chairman Fred Hampton and challenged the official story of his death. He uncovered systemic use of torture by the Chicago Police Department. And here in North Carolina, he fought on behalf of the victims of the 1979 Greensboro Massacre, a shootout between members of the Communist Workers' Party and white supremacists. In his new book, The Torture Machine, Racism and Police Violence in Chicago, Flint reflects on his career of civil rights-related cases. He's in North Carolina for events marking the 40th anniversary of the Greensboro Massacre. Flint Taylor, welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Good to have you here. Take us back to the origin of the People's Law Office. What was going on and why did you get that group started?
Well, a lot was going on, as you mentioned in your lead. It was at the height of the Vietnam War and all the Vietnam protests. That was at the height of the Black Panthers and the Young Lords Organization, a Puerto Rican activist organization. Of course, SDS, and there were other very strong radical organizations in Chicago at that time, including Rising Up Angry and the Young Patriots. And there was a very, very powerful young Black Panther leader by the name of Fred Hampton, a very charismatic 21-year-old young man. And all this was going on, and there were some young lawyers, and myself as a law student, who were committed to representing them in all the kinds of cases that they were being charged with, from selling the Black Panther Party newspaper to all sorts of other kinds of cases. And so at that point, because there was no actual institution, or I wouldn't call it an institution, but an actual office to do that in, we all started something called the People's Law Office in August of 1969 to carry on some of this work.
And as you suggest, there was just a great deal and persistent harassment of those groups by the police and the criminal justice system, right?
No doubt. It was accelerating as the year went on. And of course, culminated in the murderous raid on December 4th, 1969, coming up on 50 years this next month.
Well, yeah, you start your book with that phone call that you got one night from a member of the Black Panthers Party. Tell us about that.
Yes, it was actually in the morning of December 4th. The raid was at 4:30 in the morning, the police raid on the Black Panther Party apartment where Fred Hampton was sleeping. And soon thereafter, after the police left it, we were called by the Black Panthers to come there to take evidence, because the police left it open. They didn't seal it like you see they normally would do. And we went there to take evidence and to start to fight against the false narrative that was being promoted by the police and the head prosecutor, Edward Hanrahan, who had masterminded the raid on the apartment.
Well, talk about the narrative and what the police were saying about what happened that early morning.
Yes, the narrative that the police wanted to promote and did promote was that it was a shootout between the vicious Black Panthers, which is how they were depicted often in the media, and the police. And that, but for the grace of God, as the prosecutor who led the narrative said, the police would have been killed. But in fact, Fred Hampton was murdered in his bed. Another Black Panther leader from Peoria was also killed, and many of the Panthers who survived were badly injured. And they were all arrested for attempted murder. And as we got to the apartment, and as I described in the book, after the initial shock of seeing all the bullet holes that came from machine guns and shotguns from the police, and the blood on the floor where Fred Hampton had been dragged after he was shot in his bed, it was clear that it was not a shootout, but it was a murder scene. And so the events that I talk about in that first chapter our how over 13 years of legal and political and activist struggle, we were able to change through exposure of the evidence and fighting in the courts the narrative from it being a shootout to being a shoot-in. In fact, there were 90 or more bullets fired by the police and at most one by the Panthers to a murder, because we were able to show that Fred was asleep in his bed and most likely drugged by an FBI informant when they went in the front and back of this apartment and shot him in the head twice, to an assassination, a political assassination, because over this 13 years, we were able to uncover evidence that this COINTELPRO program, the FBI's secret illegal program that was targeting African-American black liberation struggles from Dr. King all the way to the Black Panthers, was behind the raid. And in fact, they had not only encouraged it, but the FBI informant had set it up.
Yeah, tell us more about that, because, again, even if you said, you know, you find out, no, this wasn't what the police said, they weren't defending themselves, it may still seem like they may have been there on legitimate grounds and then things went wrong. This was a deliberate attempt to commit this assassination, and it was part of an FBI program that included the infiltration of American political groups. So talk more about COINTELPRO and the way in which it was subverting democracy in America.
Well, COINTELPRO actually started and was started by guy N.J. Edgar Hoover in the mid-1900s. And at first, it was focused primarily on communist and socialist groups, and it was to disrupt people, organizations, get them fired from their jobs, totally slander them in the newspapers, that kind of active disruption. But as the black liberation struggle became strong, starting in the South and the civil rights movement, they moved to more disruptive and violent oriented types of activities. And what was its downfall to some degree was that Hoover was totally obsessed with everything being written down. So every time that a local office, a local FBI office under the control and direction of national office would do a COINTELPRO action, they would have to write it up. And so as the 60s went on and the black liberation struggle moved to the North and the Panthers became strong in places like Chicago, and leaders like Fred Hampton arose to significance, not only in the community, but also in the eyes of the FBI, they focused on them and they became even more violent, they meaning the FBI. And the COINTELPRO program, as it applied to the Panthers, was as a Senate Intelligence and Investigating Committee found in the mid-70s, was set out to destroy the Black Panther Party. Right. And in fact, the raid was actually documented, we later uncovered, as part of that COINTELPRO program.
So these are planned, and again, they would embolden local prosecutors, as you said, Hanrahan in this case, to actually set the whole thing up, go on in there, guns blazing, guys, we got you covered. The FBI is on our side.
Yes, exactly. And that's what I talk about in the rather lengthy first chapter in my book. And then after those 13 years of fighting with others to change that narrative, as I said, we were confronted with a regime of police torture in the city of Chicago.
Talk more about that and about this other reaction and the way police torture, which didn't begin then. It had been going on for quite some time, but something that you uncovered and exposed.
Yes, the torture regime was brought to Chicago from a former Vietnam veteran who was on a military police he was a military policeman on a POW camp in Vietnam, where they were using torture techniques on the Vietnamese that they had in their custody, including using electric shock. And when he came back to Chicago and became a detective on the South Side, the predominantly African-American South Side of Chicago, he had a gang of midnight detectives working with him who would interrogate suspects, selected suspects in serious cases, by using torture techniques. And the torture techniques that he and his men used included the electric shock out of a black box using a generator and wires and clips, and also other kinds of torture techniques, such as what they call dry submarino, suffocating or simulating suffocation with bags or typewriter covers over men's heads, and also mock executions by putting either shotguns or pistols into the mouth of the people that they were interrogating and simulating, but pulling the trigger but not having any shells in the gun.
You're talking about Commander, this is Commander John Burge now that you're talking about, and I think hearing this is shocking enough, but the fact that they were so emboldened and felt so protected in the use of these torture tactics that they could absolutely brag about them. They didn't even really have to cover them up.
Well, it was interesting because, yes, they would brag to each other about them. And, of course, it was during an era, the Reagan era and the Nixon era, the late Nixon era, where law and order and racism was becoming part and parcel of what law enforcement was being encouraged to do. So when they were getting these tortured confessions, so they were able to use them to send people to the penitentiary, many to death row as well. We had the death penalty in Illinois at that time. And instead of the superiors and the powers that be stopping this, investigating this, they encouraged it, and they encouraged it in several ways. And one important way was that Burge, the man that was masterminded all of this, was promoted. He became a sergeant, then he became a lieutenant, then he became a commander, until all of this became exposed outside of the what I call the torture machine. And that's the book is called The Torture Machine, and The Torture Machine has a double meaning. And the first meaning, of course, is that box I described. But the second meaning is the torture machine being the Democratic machine, what was famously known in Chicago as the Daley machine, because, of course, Richard J. Daley, the mayor for over 20 years, and then his son, Richie Daley, who was a mayor and formerly the chief prosecutor during this whole era of torture and cover-up. So if it wasn't for these prosecutors, the mayors, the police superintendents, and all the judges in the criminal court system, this couldn't have continued for 20 years, but it was facilitated and covered up in that way.
Talking to Flint Taylor, who is the author of The Torture Machine, Racism and Police Violence in Chicago. And of course, it wasn't only Chicago. I want to move to North Carolina now. In 1979, members of the Communist Workers Party hold a rally, and it ends up in an event known as the Greensboro Massacre. And you got involved in that as well. Tell us about that.
I did, partly because of our work on the Fred Hampton case. Lawyers who were working here in Greensboro, including Lewis Pitts and Carolyn McAllister, asked me to come down and participate with them in a civil rights case, a conspiracy case, not unlike the case up in Chicago that we did in the Fred Hampton case. And we worked very hard to fight against the narrative here in the same way that we were fighting to change the narrative in the Hampton case and later in the torture cases.
Remind us of what happened in 1979. Death to the Klan rally, sponsored by the Communist Workers Party, and it ends in death. Tell us what happened.
The Klan and the Nazis had formed an alliance during that period of time, and they planned to come to Greensboro because the Communist Workers Party was having a demonstration that was based in part on anti-Klan rhetoric as well as anti-Klan activities. They were resisting the Klan and the rise at that period of time of the Klan and other white supremacist groups. And they were planning and we're going to have a demonstration out in Greensboro. And the Klan very openly with the knowledge of the Greensboro police and also of the FBI, planned to come in a caravan into Greensboro with many guns in their trunks and to violently attack that demonstration. The Greensboro police had an informant who was participating in this, in fact, was in the caravan and was one of the agitators of the actual, and I wouldn't call it even a confrontation. It was, as you said, a massacre. But the police, who knew all about what might and most likely would happen, were absent. There was one police officer who was watching it and didn't do anything to stop it, even though he had all sorts of information that it was, that the Klan was going to attack. The rest of the officers in the department were having coffee at the time. And so in broad daylight, in front of the TV cameras who were filming this event, the Klan got out with shotguns, rifles, and other weapons and mowed down five of the demonstrators and wounded many of the others. And that led to many years of struggle to try to expose the truth that, in fact, it wasn't any kind of shootout, like it was not a shootout in Chicago, but rather a massacre. And this is the 40th anniversary, if you can call it that, of November 3rd, which was when this happened. And over that lawsuit and also with all the activism that went on all those years down here in Greensboro, we brought much of that truth out in terms of the police's role primarily and the FBI's knowledge. And, of course, it was there for all to see on videotape. The murders itself. And yes, the Klan and Nazis were very proud of that. And they were able to get acquitted in murder cases that were brought against them and then acquitted of charges with regard to civil rights violations. So ours was a civil rights, civil case for damages. And that's what we tried in 1985. And we were able to get a verdict against some of the Klansmen, some of the Nazis, and most significantly against some of the police that were integrally involved in allowing this to happen.
Yeah, it's fascinating because, as you said, at least two criminal trials in which the Klan or the shooters, the murderers in this case, were exonerated. They were acquitted. Civil cases in which they were acquitted as well. But in this case, the police, perhaps for the first time in American history, were absolutely found guilty of complicity with white supremacist organizations.
Yes, and, you know, so one thing we learned and we were also trying to show was you can look back in history to all of the times during the civil rights movement where the FBI and the police and the sheriff's department would be complicit in Klan violence or during the civil rights struggle to allow that to happen, having full knowledge. There was a blueprint for what happened in Greensboro, for what happened with civil rights workers in the South. And then as we move forward now and look backwards, we see Charlottesville. And we see what happened in Charlottesville with white supremacists, and we see also what the police did and didn't do in Charlottesville. And so we have a continuum here, unfortunately, historical events that take you right to Charlottesville and to what's happening today in this country. And, of course, people like the people in the past who have fought against these terrible events and attempted to, and in some ways helped to change the narrative, are so integral to this day in terms of resisting white supremacy and police violence as we have it on our doorstep now.
Flint Taylor, founding partner of the People's Law Office in Chicago. His new book is called The Torture Machine, Racism and Police Violence in Chicago. Going to be at Bennett College in Greensboro on Saturday for a series of panels and workshops commemorating the 40th anniversary of the Greensboro Massacre. Thanks so much for talking with us, Flint.
Thank you.
Just ahead, the music of Julia. Stay with us.